Welcome to the Femi Pod. These conversations are for women runners that go beyond running. Brought to you by your Femi founders, Lydia O'Donnell and Esther Kuhn. To the Femi Pod. This week we are incredibly excited to welcome to the pod a very well-known nutritional biochemist, author and founder, Dr. Libby Weaver. Australia's Dr. Libby has over 25 years of clinical experience, has written 12 books, and has now built her own supplement company called BioBlends. Dr. Libby not only speaks to the ins and outs of nutrition, but also how to take a holistic approach to your overall health and well-being. Welcome to the Femi Pod, Dr. Libby. How are you today?
I'm so very well. Thank you, Lydia. Thanks so much for having me join you.
I am so excited to chat with you today. As I was saying before we started recording, I've been a longtime fan and it feels like you've been kind of in this health and wellness space for such a long time, particularly when I was back in Aotearoa in New Zealand. I know your name was just massive in the space. So I'm really excited to jump into the conversation today, not just about kind of your career as a nutritional biochemist, but what I also get excited about is your ability to hustle hard as a businesswoman, but also look after yourself. So we're going to get more into that later in the conversation. But just to start, nutritional biochemist is, I believe, a term maybe not a lot of people have heard before or know about. So can you give us a little insight into your career and what a nutritional biochemist really is?
Sure can. Thank you, Lydia. Yeah, so I went to university for 14 years, which I know makes me sound really thick and like I failed everything, but I very much love learning and I still do. So I originally studied nutrition and dietetics and then I graduated with honours and then did a PhD in biochemistry. So I blended that nutrition and dietetics degree with my PhD in biochemistry so that it sort of fostered me to look at, when I'm working with people one-on-one, when I used to do that, I was very much looking at three pillars, their biochemistry, so what's happening with their blood work, what's happening inside them, the nutritional parameters, because every biochemical pathway inside of us needs nutrients to actually operate. And then, of course, I'm just the human side of me is always so curious about our emotional landscape. So I kind of combined my 14 years at uni with my 25 years of clinical experience to create that three-pillar approach where I look at biochemistry, nutrition, and emotion. So that was the term I came up with, was nutritional biochemist, to sort of try to describe what I do, but it's essentially a pretty holistic approach.
Yes, I'm very excited to jump into those three pillars. But kind of what got you to even study that in the first place? Did you grow up with this kind of interest in food and nutrition?
You're so sweet to ask that. I've reflected on it obviously a lot in my life, and I grew up very, very simply. Mum and Dad still live in the same house where I grew up, and we had chickens in the backyard and we grew some of our own food. But I was really fortunate that I had parents who spoke to me just in not making a fuss about it. It was just general conversation. You know, if you got an orange off the tree, it was, oh, this has got vitamin C in it and that helps you to maybe not get a cold. Helps you not to get sick, that kind of thing. My grandmother used to visit. She didn't live in the same town as us, and she used to visit sometimes, and this is in the 70s. So she was a lady really ahead of her time, and she used to bring this little suitcase that had nutritional supplements in it, and it had wheat germ for some extra fiber. And so I was curious about this funny little suitcase, and she'd take her supplements. It was vitamin C and vitamin E. And no one talked about supplements back then. This is, as I said, in the 1970s. So, and she didn't ever bring me chocolate and things like that. She would bring me a pottle of yogurt, and she used to say to me, and as a treat, you can put a teaspoon of honey in it. So I think that'll have had some kind of impact. And then I was active as a child. Tennis was my sport. I played tennis at least four times a week. Loved it, was pretty obsessed with it. And then when my period started when I was 14, they weren't consistent in the beginning, which is really common. They were really random. And my mum, after about 9 months of that, my mum was just a little concerned, and she took me to the GP about that. And that's when I discovered that I was iron deficient myself. And it was the first, it's obviously incredibly common because our iron requirements go up when we do start to menstruate. But as an adult now, I look back on that with so much gratitude for my mum, because she didn't know, obviously. And I'm also very grateful to the GP for getting onto it, you know, kind of quickly. So I feel like all of that hugely contributed to my curiosity around the impact that nutrition has on how we feel and function. So that was a part of it. And when I was really little, when I was four, mum gave me a diary. And when I was four, the only thing I could write in it was how many eggs I collected from the chickens. But I kept a journal ever since then. And so when I first went to uni, I studied journalism because I loved writing and I really enjoyed it. And but then I realized I only really wanted to write about human health and human behavior and nutrition. So then I did psychology next, because I've always had this question in our heads, why do we do what we do, even though we know what we know? People might have, you know, some really robust knowledge in an area, but they're not necessarily applying it to themselves to look after themselves. So that was a curiosity. But I didn't love that kind of conventional psychological approach, if I'm honest. And that was when I then went and studied nutrition and loved it from day one. It was instant. So a bit of a rounded way to kind of get there. But it's sort of, I felt that nutrition really combined, yeah, so much of the stuff I was curious about in life.
That's so interesting. I think the fact that you studied psychology, it all makes sense now in terms of the way that you approach speaking about food and like this really holistic approach. Because when I think you look at your biography, you cover so many different topics and it's not just food, you know. And I found that super interesting because I also try to not look at food as just food. Like it really has such an impact on your entire well-being, your life, how you think, how you act, relationships you build. I guess that all comes back to your three-pillar approach as well. And it's, yeah, fascinating. I think the psychology piece is something that we all underestimate, and controlling that narrative in your mind and the way you think about yourself is so important. And it can just completely change your relationship with yourself and with your food and fuel. But going back to yourself as a teenager and going through puberty and going through menses and getting your period and then having these iron issues, I feel like you're telling my story, because I started getting my period when I was 12, and pretty much from then on, and even till today, I have had pretty severe iron issues. And I remember going to the doctor, I would have been about 14, I think, and I was having these breathing issues when I was competing in races. And somehow I connected the dots. And it was like, when I had my period, I was facing these breathing issues, and I know that I had low iron. And so I remember saying to the doctor, is there a link between these three things? And of course he said, no, not at all. And now I look back and I'm like, man, I wish I knew more about like iron and the link between periods and how it was impacting my performance then, because even now, you know, what is it now, 25 years later or something, and I'm like still suffering from having low iron. So
congrats on your new book, Fix Iron First, The One Thing That Changes Everything.
Very, very needed. I feel like the world needs to know more about iron, and we do speak a lot about it at FEMI. We have our amazing medical experts, Dr. Claire Bardenhurst, who you may know has done some pretty interesting studies around iron as well. But I still don't know if there's enough education out there for the general population to understand the impact of iron. So was it from your teenage years that you kind of got this interest in iron and how it impacts your overall health and well-being?
So when it's funny that you ask that, Lydia, because when I was first writing the book, I would have said no, but I could see as I continued that writing process, it's definitely contributed. And I can see, I think there's a saying, this is not my saying, I've read it somewhere, but our voids create our values. So in other words, when we perceive we lack something, when we perceive there's something missing in our life, we put it really high up on our values list and we pursue it. And so given that that was the first nutritional deficiency I experienced as a teenager since I've been in my earth suit, I think that there is no question that that's had an impact. I just was not so consciously aware of it before I started writing the book. I actually wrote I started writing a book at the start of 2024, and it was about a completely different topic. But the first, and I wrote 65,000 words of that book, but the first 11,000 words were all about iron. And I was really struggling to continue writing that book because all I wanted to talk about was iron, because of my age, I'm 50, and I was working with a lot of perimenopausal women. And I was barely not having conversations with any women who had robust iron levels at that point, at that stage, for that transition in their life. And what we were finding was that when we restored iron levels to be far more robust, so many of their symptoms that they thought were due to hormonal changes on their own actually improved. For some, they resolved when their iron became far more robust. And so that's why I used the tagline I have with the book. Obviously, fix iron first is the thing I want to encourage people to do first, is focus on that and restore that, and let's just see what's left over, because it can be the one thing that changes everything. So it was that. And also, I was just in the street, or I don't know, I'd go to the hairdresser, or just, you know, random conversations with people who I didn't know, and I'd bring it up because it was all I wanted to talk about, because I get a bit obsessed with things, and I'd bring up iron deficiency, and they'd just say, oh yeah, I'm iron deficient. Like they're saying, oh yeah, I had a drink of water this morning. Like, it was really just casual. And if I said, oh, and how, you know, were you able to resolve that? Or what were you able to do to address that? Oh, well, isn't everybody? That was sort of, I found it was just being dismissed as, you know, it affects so many women. And that's true. Sadly, it does. But I feel because it is so common now, we're not necessarily really motivated or necessarily empowered with the right information to actually do something about it. And I don't think we realize the ripple effect of not dealing with it. You know, for example, we need iron to produce our neurotransmitters, dopamine for motivation, GABA, which is very calming, serotonin, a sort of a happy, calm, content hormone. Our thyroid hormone production is completely reliant on iron. And a lot of women with an underactive thyroid, the symptoms of an underactive thyroid sort of mimic iron deficiency to a degree, and that sort of mimics a lot of the symptoms that a lot of women attribute to perimenopause. So there's all this overlap, and it's why testing can be really helpful and offer great insight. So yeah, it was the sort of the lack of it being addressed in a really clear way that made me think, I want to bring this to life. And beyond that, sorry, once you get me started, it's hard to stop it. Just one final thing. It's that it is the most common nutritional deficiency in the world is so unacceptable to me. We know about it and we have ways to resolve it, and we're not doing enough. You know, there are, even when I think about children, there are children who live in very loving homes and their parents won't necessarily realize that one of their children is iron deficient. There are children who come from really hard places, they won't get breakfast before they go to school, they're going to be iron deficient. And then there's children in developing countries who don't have access to iron-rich foods. And I get goosebumps when I talk about it. It's hard not to get really choked up when I talk about it. I can't live with that. So and I want this body of work that I'm creating now to spark interest as far-reaching way as possible to resolve this issue, because there's so much unnecessary suffering. As you described your experience growing up, and sadly it's so incredibly common, especially for girls.
Yeah, it is really sad. And I think it's something like 30% or maybe more of women are iron deficient. Is that right?
Yeah, and there was a study actually came out at the start of last year. It was looking at girls in the US aged between 12 and 22, and it was 39.8% of them had iron deficiency anemia, which is the most severe form. And then a less severe form but still impacts us is just straightforward iron deficiency. So there'll be way more. So iron deficiency anemia was affecting nearly 40% of girls aged in that age group. And yeah, the symptoms that come from it, that's not talked about enough. So yeah.
No, exactly. And I think I still, to this day, don't really quite understand why I'm so iron deficient. And I've had so many tests done, and I have been getting blood tests regularly and I take iron supplements and I've even had infusions and I still don't quite know. I have heavy periods and I definitely understand that that can contribute, but there's no kind of reason to why I have heavy periods. So I'm kind of stuck in this like rut of like, how can I get to the bottom of my like iron? Because we still don't really know why I have the heavy periods in the first place. But that's a whole like podcast in itself, I think, to try and unpack that one. But I think you mentioned like the impact of low iron on thyroid. And I know you speak about the impact on anxiety as well. Can you dive a little bit deeper into that?
Let's do thyroid first. So if you can imagine that the pituitary gland at the base of the brain sends a message to the thyroid gland to get it to wake up and make its hormones. So the pituitary gland hormone is called TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. And if someone goes to their GP to have a blood test about their thyroid, that's usually the only one that gets tested. That's not okay in my book, but that's typically what will occur. So the TSH gets measured, but I want listeners to really vibe with that's the pituitary calling out to the thyroid to get it to make its hormones. And then the thyroid hormones are T4 and T3. T4 is inactive thyroid hormone and T3 is our active thyroid hormone that helps us to have a superstar metabolic rate, that helps us to have superstar energy, helps us to think clearly, helps us to regulate our temperature. When our thyroid's not working properly, we can feel quite cold. Classic iron deficiency symptoms is kind of cold and grumpy, even though we might not reveal that to others. So once the TSH calls out to the thyroid to get it to make T4, if you can imagine that I get people to imagine that T4 is like a bus, but it's the structure of the bus. And then we have to attach iodine to the wheels of the bus to create that thyroid hormone. And to actually build that structure, it's completely reliant on iron. And then that's the inactive thyroid hormone. T3 looks just like that, except it's had one iodine removed. And there's an enzyme, there are a couple of enzymes that are needed to convert the inactive thyroid hormone into the active one that makes us feel good. And one enzyme is dependent on selenium and the other one is dependent on iron. So when... Again, it's why nutritional biochemistry fully spins my tires, because when we don't understand the impact of nutrients, people just go, well, my thyroid's not working properly, or I've got an underactive thyroid. But for some people, we can peel it back and actually see it's very straightforward nutritional deficiencies. And if we address those, everything improves. I have a phrase that I use in my work, Lydia, which is the road in is the road out. So whatever's created the challenge in someone, we want to address that thing. And in this case, or in this example, if it's iron deficiency that's causing the thyroid to not be able to make enough hormones, so therefore it looks like you've got an underactive thyroid, if you restore someone's iron levels, in this example, their thyroid function will come right. So that's the big impact on thyroid hormones. And then obviously if we think about, if you imagine that our physical structure, our earth suit, our body is made up of about 50 trillion cells, and I get people to imagine that as a cell is someone took a pencil and drew a circle. So that's a cell, and every cell in our body has receptors for thyroid hormones and also vitamin D, interestingly, which shows you how powerful and how important that nutrient is. So every cell in the body needs thyroid hormones to be able to function, and that's why the symptoms of an underactive thyroid are so widespread. But that also means that's another reason why the symptoms of iron deficiency are so widespread, because we can't make thyroid hormones without good iron. And a really common pattern I've seen in women over the years is they'll be kind of going along okay, and then in their 40s, when ovulation starts to become irregular as they begin their perimenopausal transition, obviously when we don't ovulate, we don't make that lovely big surge of progesterone, and the thyroid loves progesterone. And often in those early 40s, a lot of women have lived with iron deficiency for decades at that point. And the thyroid then says, I can't do this anymore. I've been trying to, hold up my end of the bargain for such a long time. And then it'll be in sort of, it's common in the 40s for women to then find out their thyroid's not working as well as it once did. Either it's fully underactive or it's just underperforming. They don't have a disease. It's just not working as well as it once did. And I just simply see that as the compounding effects of how we've been living up until that point in time. And again, it's why I'm so keen for women to address iron deficiency and also, you know, do what we can to make the thyroid work as well as it can, because yeah, the ripple effect, the symptoms of an underactive thyroid are pretty significant, particularly obviously with energy. But we, our hair starts to fall out. There's pretty dramatic effects. Then rounding back to the other part of your question, when it comes to anxiety, it's the one of the classic symptoms of iron deficiency actually is anxiety and heart palpitations, heart racing. And I think it's hard enough for us as adults to piece everything together. It's really difficult for teenagers. Obviously, they can be, we know especially that teenage girls can be terribly detrimentally impacted by social media use, because particularly because of comparison. And there's some really robust research coming out now to actually demonstrate, you know, genuine concern for young girls' exposure to social media, particularly related to body image. And then if you then, and so it's very easy to think that if a child feels really anxious, it's really easy for them to think that it's, you know, probably that. But what I'm concerned is that iron deficiency is completely being missed in that conversation. So when we don't have enough iron, the heart has to pump faster to deliver more oxygen throughout the body. And that can feel quite uncomfortable in our chest. And so if you then couple that with worrying about your friends at school, or, you know, your grades or your sporting performance, that, you know, worrying about the things you care about, essentially, you kind of couple that together, and it's really easy for children to be essentially misdiagnosed with a condition when it's actually iron deficiency. There's a terrific paper was published in 2022 showing essentially all the psychiatric manifestations of iron deficiency, and anxiety in teenagers was one of the biggest topics. And the authors actually stated that they're deeply concerned about the overprescription of, you know, other things for anxiety when there's a chance that it's iron deficiency. And that's a story that I'm busting to bring to life to hopefully have, because if you think, let's say you're diagnosed with anxiety when you're 15, you then grow up thinking that there's something not quite right with you. And that when you grow up believing that you have a condition or that you don't quite fit in, it changes every choice you make. We don't see it at the time. You can only see it in hindsight, but it affects your belief in your own intelligence or the education you think that you are capable of pursuing. It impacts the friendships you make. It impacts the relationships you establish. And even it impacts, I think, the relationships we stay in. Because if you think that there's something wrong with you, which often translates into I'm not good enough or I'm not okay, there's something wrong with me, and you're in an intimate relationship, if you're on the receiving end of lousy behavior, I think we can too easily, as women, stay too long because we think no one else will ever care about us because there's something wrong with us. So I guess I look to the big picture ripple effect of when we perceive there's something wrong with us, when it can be just something as straightforward as iron deficiency. You know, and I'm not saying that obviously if we have anxiety that there's something wrong with us, it's a symptom, you know, that we're struggling and that needs whatever support it needs. There's no judgment on that. My concern is that I think there's a lot of false diagnosis when it's just iron deficiency that could be actually treated, and then we grow up with a completely different perception about ourselves.
Oh my gosh, yes, I couldn't be on the same page more. I am really passionate about like the overprescription of medication for people who are suffering from anxiety and depression. And I totally understand that there are instances and cases where there's a chemical imbalance and people need the medication. But I remember listening to, I can't remember who exactly it was speaking about it, but it was probably about 10 years ago, about endogenous and exogenous depression. And I grew up in a family where I had multiple people in my family suffering pretty severe mental health issues. And I remember learning about exogenous depression and how, you know, your circumstances that you're facing around you can actually impact the way that you feel about yourself or how you feel in your day-to-day. When people are getting prescribed medication, they actually could just be changing their environment first and seeing if that makes a difference before they actually become medicated. Because I also have seen people who are heavily reliant on medication, and that is also very concerning. But the iron, I've never really even heard about the connection between anxiety and low iron, but it definitely makes so much sense. I think as an athlete growing up with low iron, the story is all about transporting oxygen to your muscles and how fast you can run based off how much iron you have. It's never how anxious you feel because of the iron and the heart pumping and trying to get the oxygen around. Like, it's always about your performance in a physical format. But now I'm like, yeah, well, all of that makes so much sense. And also my anxiety changes throughout the month depending on where I'm at in my cycle, and that is also related to iron, right?
Yeah, and progesterone, and yeah, exactly. And so it's, you know, there's lots of people doing such great work in this area to help us have a much bigger, more holistic understanding of what we experience each month. And that's exciting. It's not, I mean, it's just beginning really, isn't it? And your work at FEMI is doing a huge job to, you know, spread that information. So yeah, keep that up.
Oh, thank you. Yes. And we're going to move on from iron soon, but my last kind of question is to you is, what are your, I guess, top three tips when it comes to someone who is suffering from low iron?
So firstly, be aware of when you have increased requirements. So obviously across the menstruation years, we need 18 milligrams of iron per day just to prevent deficiency. If someone eats in a vegan or vegetarian way, they need to multiply that RDI by 1.8. So that means you need 32 milligrams of iron per day. Even a really, what I call a robust eater, so someone who eats for satiety, who doesn't have any kind of dieting mentality, they just eat for great health and energy, it's really hard to eat, you know, even 18 milligrams of iron per day. You can, but it's not easy. So if someone is restricting in any way, which is not what I encourage, you know, if someone has coffee for lunch, coffee is not lunch, but if someone has coffee for lunch, then there's no way they're going to meet their iron needs in a day. And then obviously for female athletes across the menstruation years, requirements sit at around, because of the increased requirements with endurance performance, the requirements sit around 30 milligrams of iron per day. So again, really hard to eat enough. So I think the awareness of the importance of getting as much iron as we can from our food, but then also realizing that there are times in our life when supplementation is crucial. And I've actually spent the last 5 years developing an iron supplement, and I don't say that lightly, and I don't say that to promote it, but I did trials with women with low ferritin, because BioBlends is my supplement company and we make everything from food, so not synthetic. And I tried all sorts of foods to get women's iron levels up. So we recruited 20 women who had a ferritin iron storage of less than 30, and I used another food-based source of iron, and none of them improved. Two of them stayed the same, and the rest of their iron levels got worse. So it's not all iron supplements out there are going to work. So obviously I couldn't live with, you know, releasing that thing, that ingredient that I trialed. I now have Iconic Iron that I've developed, and the iron is actually in a completely different form. It's called ferritin iron, and it's from organic peas. And its absorption mechanism is completely different from your normal ferrous or ferric iron. So the ferritin iron is actually, if you imagine, the ferritin is like a cage that the plant just naturally makes. Humans, we make our own ferritin as well to store iron in. But in this case, in the peas make this ferritin cage, and they pop all the iron inside this ferritin cage. So then when we swallow the Iconic Iron supplement, the iron is actually delivered past the gut wall, so our gut cells are not exposed to the free iron, which is what happens with normal iron supplements that causes constipation and all sorts of other things that people often experience. So yeah, the research on the Iconic Iron is far superior bioavailability. So I'm super excited to bring that to life and better tell that story. So yeah, my solutions essentially are become very aware of your iron needs and recognize when you might not be able to meet your iron requirements from food alone. And then I'd encourage people to look at Iconic Iron and the difference that ferritin iron makes. It's got such great research behind it.
Fascinating. That sounds so interesting. I have always struggled with absorbing iron. So I've been on iron supplements my whole life, but I can never seem to get it up. So maybe this is my solution.
Yeah, it's just so common, Lydia. It's anyway, the research, I won't go on too much about it, but what's so inspiring about it, the research has actually been done over the last just over 20 years by a lady called Professor Elizabeth Thiel, and she was the one who actually found that that ferritin iron had a unique absorption mechanism. It was the basis of her PhD. So it's actually been born out of someone really caring about resolving this globally, and I've taken on that baton.
Incredible. That's so exciting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have heard about Dr. Claire Buddenhurst's research that she's running at the moment about menstrual blood, but we just did a deep dive for our FEMI members in the podcast. People can go and listen to the conversation. But essentially one of the big problems, I guess challenges that I find with my iron is that trying to find time in my diary to go and go to the doctor, get a referral, get a blood test, go back to the doctor to get the results, try and find a way to get around it. Like, it's sounds maybe not so bad, but when you're a busy gal and you've got lots going on, it's hard to find the time. So her research is understanding the biomarkers that we can pick up from menstrual blood. And if I have a tool to tell me every cycle where I'm at with my iron, it would just solve, again, so many problems. So it's really exciting research that's going on.
I learned about that through you guys. I learned about her research through FEMI. It's and again, the more that we understand that and put the tools in women's hands, I think that we can, as you say, a lot of us are busy, and what you describe about going to the doctor, blah, blah, blah. We can self-refer blood tests as well, but some people are really good at that, and others probably, you've got to be able to interpret results. That's the trouble in doing that. So the more that, we understand from our menstrual blood and all of that exciting research that's happening, how empowering for us to be able to work that out ourselves.
Definitely. Yeah, it's all about knowledge. Knowledge is so empowering. So we're just so excited to continue to get the best of the best knowledge out there. Mm. And you also wrote a book, Rushing Woman Syndrome. Was that in 2011? Am I right? Yeah, so a while ago now, but it's still so relatable today. And at FEMI, our community are definitely the women who are, trying to do it all. We love to work hard. We love to set big, ambitious goals and chase them, whether that's in running or in our careers or even in our relationships. So why do you think it is that it seems to be this rushing woman syndrome very much tied to women and not maybe so much tied to men?
I think it comes through in men in completely different ways, and it was why I wanted to focus on women on their own in that book. Our psychology is so different. So I wrote that book in 2011, and naively, I just thought it was a bit of a glitch in the matrix. I thought that this new experience I was having with my patients of them being kind of way more intense than they used to be, I just thought it was this momentary glitch in time and that we would go back to a slower pace again. Well, I was completely wrong, and everything's only sped up since 2011. Yeah. But I wrote the book. I think it's important for listeners to know it's not a medical condition. It's just the name of my book, Rushing Woman Syndrome. And it was the name I gave essentially a cluster of symptoms that I was seeing in, women who essentially had the biggest hearts. So when I first sort of was looking at it, I can describe what happens with the sympathetic nervous system versus the parasympathetic nervous system. We can look at what happens when we live in the fight or flight response and the way that disrupts, regular ovulation and therefore robust progesterone production. We can look at all of that. We can look at the effects of adrenaline and cortisol. We can look at what happens when we've pushed ourselves for too long and cortisol becomes really low. So that's kind of all the biochemistry of rushing woman syndrome. We can look at the fact that a lot of rushing women don't eat enough total food, or they're not eating regularly because they're so busy they don't necessarily prioritize making sure they're getting nutrient density going in with as many mouthfuls as possible to fuel themselves. I said earlier, coffee is not lunch. For a rushing woman, coffee is often what they pick for lunch. So when I was seeing all of that and then coupling it together, but my brain always goes, why? And what I could see back then was that we did it. We rushed because we care so much. We care, about how another person might feel. We care about someone feeling like we're prioritizing them. We care about being the best possible colleague that we can be, the best possible daughter, mother, sister, friend. All of that comes from this magnificent place. And then I got to that point in my contemplation of it all back then. And then it dawned on me, yes, we care about others very deeply, but we also care what they think of us. And that's where I think the gold really is where we go and explore. And I call it forward words. I used to say to my patients, they'd walk through the door of my practice and I'd sometimes, this will sound super random, but I would sometimes basically see a word written across their forehead. And I just took it as a little moment to I just think I'll bring that topic up with them later. But quite often it was a trait. So I do this exercise with people now and I'll say to them, how do you need others to see you? Name the traits. And it will be different for different people. So the traits you need your mother to see in you might be completely different from the traits you need your boss to see in you or your partner. So you can split it up into the people kind of who are in your inner circle and ask yourself, how do I need them to see me? And write it down. So for rushing women, the most common words that would come out of their mouth when I did this exercise with them was that they needed people to see them as kind, thoughtful, and selfless. So it's very, whereas for other women, they'll say, I need to be seen as competent, intelligent, relatable, efficient, hardworking. So it doesn't matter what the traits are, but you need to know what yours are and what's really important to you that others see in you. And then the next time you're stressed, pause and consider, am I perceiving someone is seeing me in the opposite way to my forward words? And most of the time the answer will be yes. So when I wrote a book called, that was Rushing Woman Syndrome. And then in 2019, I wrote a book called The Invisible Load. And prior to that, I ran focus groups with women of different ages. And the youngest group were aged 18 to 25. And when I asked them what their biggest stresses were, by far and away, their biggest stresses were their body image and social media. And when I share, if I'm speaking publicly to an audience and I share that, and if the audience is made up of people older than that, they make noises, or some of them you can see they feel really sad about that. Others are really judgy about that and they kind of roll their eyes or go, they scoff at it because they can't imagine, they can't understand how social media can be a stress. And what I could see through that is that if we allow it, our stress can be one of our biggest teachers, because younger people care about social media because it's one of the ways through which they seek consciously or unconsciously the approval of others. Whereas, you know, I might use social media to watch wombat videos because I think wombats are hilarious. So social media is not stressful for me. It's entertaining watching hilarious little wombats run around. So whereas when I did the interviews with women aged between 35 and 55, it wasn't the number one, but it was a very common stress was running late. But not everybody stresses out about running late, which is how you know it's not real. It's how you know it's unique to you and it's coming from your thinking. Again, no judgment. You know, you might get stressed about running late because you're going to a conference and you don't want to miss the first speaker. So there's a bit of FOMO there. Or you might get stressed about running late because you actually care about what the person who's going to be on the receiving end of your running late is going to think of you. And that's where the juice is. So when we get really stressed and get into that rushing kind of state, yes, our lives are full. Yes, our lives are busy. Yes, we can have days that are jam-packed with being in service of others. We can have days that are jam-packed with a blend of doing stuff that really spins our tires and lights us up, and stuff that is weighs heavy on us as a responsibility, almost like a have to, not as it, I get to do this. It sort of, there's stuff we feel like we get to do, and there's stuff we feel like we have to do. So, and obviously our days can be very full, but we can choose to see that as a ridiculous gift while we get our turn on earth, or we can carry it in a really heavy way and feel the pressure of that. I'm not trying to be Pollyanna, because there's, you know, there's very real and genuine stress going on in the world right now. There's very real and genuine stress going on in people's lives. there is also a huge amount of stress we create for ourselves because of how we think. And that's the part we can change. So that's what excites me, is things we can change, not the stuff we can't move, you know. Mm-hmm. And this judgment, or the judgment we pass on ourselves for how we've shown up, or a conversation we had, or it's where that, the minute we judge, we're blind to any kind of insight. But when we get really curious about, I wonder why I got so worked up, I wonder why I got so kind of stressed out about, you know, X, Y, Z. If you can pause and see, were you worried about what someone was thinking of you in that moment? It then changes your approach. You can either have a giggle at yourself and hold it lightly, or it might mean you go and have a conversation with that person. It might be your boss. You ran late for the meeting and you say, hey, it's really important to me that you know I value my job. I ran late this morning because all sorts of chaos broke out at home, but it's important to me that you know I value my job. They're just going to think you're awesome if, you know, you're pouring your heart out like that. Whereas if you don't say that and you've turned up for work late and you feel like people think badly of you, you run yourself ragged trying to prove to them what you want them to see in you. And then after a day like that, you'll go home and say, oh, today was so stressful, when it actually wasn't. You kind of made it that way. So I try to get rushing woman syndrome and the invisible load. I try to get, provide tools for us to go deeper into what feels like it's kind of just how life is. You know, it's they're tools to go deeper, I hope. Yeah.
Yes, this is, I guess, where all of the psychology stuff is so interesting, right? And I believe women have grown up, particularly my generation of women have grown up in this like patriarchal world, yet women are starting to make a move, and we are nowhere near equality, but we are making at least a step forward in the right direction. And I mean, I can speak really from my own experience, is that I constantly feel like I have to be grateful for every opportunity that I get and take every opportunity that I get and almost live up to this perfectionistic person that I'm not perfect, but I try to be, because I feel like that's kind of the person we have to fulfill as women, because women never used to have these opportunities, and now that we do, we're going to have to go 110% to make the most of them. And then we run ourselves ragged because we're going so hard, we're not stopping and we're not recovering and resting, and then it kind of falls back into these potential health problems and issues. Where at FEMI, we talk about sustainability a lot, and sustainability, obviously, at FEMI is about running and the ability to back up training after weeks and months and years, because that's where you become a better runner. But sustainability and endurance isn't just about sport or running or fitness. Like, it really is about life and being able to constantly be living a really full life, but not putting your health on the line as well. So can you talk a little bit about how this rushing woman syndrome idea manifests into potential health issues?
Yeah, so, well, certainly period problems is one of them, because if you think, when we're rushing, we make a fair bit of adrenaline, and adrenaline historically said to every cell in our body that our life was in danger, because the only time in the fairly recent past as a human species, we only made adrenaline when, you know, someone from another tribe jumped out of the jungle at us with their spear, and in that moment we'd go and get ready to fight the fight or run away. Whereas now we make adrenaline in response to, everyone needs to block their ears right now because you won't like this bit, but we make adrenaline when we consume caffeine, we make adrenaline because of our perceptions of pressure and urgency, because we're consciously or unconsciously worrying what someone else thinks of us, et cetera. So it's way more psychological now, so it's persistent. And so when that message is so persistent rather than short-lived the way it used to be, so if you think, we used to just live with low adrenaline and then there'd be a threat, we'd spike the adrenaline and then the threat was over, back to normal, whereas now it just kind of climbs all day and then it probably comes off the edge a bit when we go to sleep. Or if we're not sleeping properly, it can be a sign that our adrenaline is staying high. So because of that, that says to every cell in our body that we're not safe. And because ovulation means that you can conceive, that that's possible, I think one of the big impacts is, can be on period regularity, on robust progesterone production, because stress can be such a disruptor to healthy ovulation. Obviously conception, fertility can be impacted as well, because when adrenaline is saying you're not safe, your body thinks, well, the best thing for us is to not ovulate because we can't risk bringing a baby into a world where there is this lack of safety. So that's when, back in 2011, I was seeing it hugely as all sorts of period problems because of progesterone insufficiency, which comes from lack of ovulation or a lack of robust ovulation. So that, coupled with lousy sleep. So sleep is obviously such a foundation for our well-being and how we feel and function every day. And when we lose the ability to do something so biologically fundamental to our survival, I see the body as this magnificent vehicle of communication, and I see symptoms as whispers, or sometimes they roar at us to get our attention because we're not picking up the cues that things need to change. So sleep was a big one. And I would say to my patients, you know, you're getting information right now that it's feedback that, you know, this the challenges with sleep, that something needs to change with the way that you eat, drink, move, think, breathe, believe, or perceive, or it could be a number of those areas. And I would, a big part of my work is helping women trust themselves again, because we all have a voice inside us that has our back. Most people know mostly what would be a nourishing lunch for them to have. They just don't necessarily do it. We know when we've been sitting at our computer for too long and it's time to get up and stretch or go outside or have a drink of water, but we don't often listen to it. So sleep disruption was a big thing. Obviously, with rushing women, either they couldn't fall asleep or they couldn't stay asleep. Then there were the gut problems. So when we have a nice balanced autonomic nervous system, so when there's a lovely balance between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, that really helps our gut function to be great, because we're supposed to have really good gut supply to our digestive system. But when the fight or flight response is activated, blood gets diverted away from digestion to the periphery, to our arms and legs, which is great when we want to, you know, sprint. We need it to fuel. We need the oxygen. We need the nutrients being delivered to the periphery. Gut function is compromised. So it's a highly adaptive and terrific mechanism if we want to perform with exercise, or historically when we needed to run away from a threat, that was a really efficient thing to happen. But now, because we live with constantly elevated adrenaline levels, gut function can be dramatically compromised. And we understand food can play a role in that, but I don't think we understand or talk about enough the impact that stress has. And it's adrenaline diverts blood away from digestion to your arms and your legs. And 1 in 5 women in Australia and New Zealand actually have irritable bowel syndrome. And as I said, food plays a role in that, but so does this stress response, and it's not talked about enough. So that was sort of the cluster of symptoms that I saw. And if all of that persists for too long, you can see changes, you know, in thyroid function. There's all sorts of things that, when that lasts, when it's not addressed, you know, other things happen down the track, can unfold down the track. But what I was trying to do in grouping it all together, I think there were a lot of women who didn't know where to start. You know, they'd say, well, I've got terrible trouble with my gut, and I've got terrible trouble with my periods and my sleep. I've got all of that, and they don't know where to start. And that's where the, you know, small changes with eating in a more nourishing way can be great, but so is starting to explore how you need other people to see you, because that then takes the edge off that persistent stress response. Also, too, another thing that I talk about, this is more in the invisible load, I get people to name their values. And what I mean by, when I say values, I don't mean ethical preferences like kindness or generosity. I mean, what does your life actually demonstrate that you value? Because we all get 24 hours, and what we choose to spend our time on shows us what we value, and we look after what we care about. So when, you know, there's all sorts of awful messaging out there trying to get people to better look after themselves, you know, if you don't look after yourself, you know, you might develop XYZ condition. I don't believe that works. Maybe it works for men, but because they respond to challenge, and I think the feminine responds to praise. It certainly didn't, it's not my style, and not what I think works for people. I think we look after what we care about. So if we live more in touch, if we live more in absolute awe of our physical structure, we will probably just make a little bit better choices. And when I say better, I just mean more nourishing in a really holistic sense. You know, if you catch up with your favorite person on a Friday night, you know, you're there for the soul connection. That's soul nourishment. That's not thinking about what you're eating or what you're drinking. That's you there connecting with this human who you treasure, right? That's the nourishment in that moment on that occasion. Whereas, you know, if it's an ordinary Monday night, hopefully you're going to cook yourself a nourishing dinner and the focus is on your actual nutritional nourishment. So I think remembering to look at that big picture of nourishment and what's in your nourishment bucket, what do you value? I try to get women to really be in awe of their body so that their choices come from a place of deep caring rather than I better eat more nutritiously.
I love that so much. I feel like women have grown up beating themselves up, hating their bodies, beating their bodies up, exercising to lose weight, and changing the way that you speak to yourself and that narrative and that little mind, that little voice that's inside your mind, like trying to lean into those positive thoughts. I also agree, can just completely change your entire like relationship with yourself, but also your health and your wellness. And it's that real holistic approach. And I feel like holistic has probably been overused and become almost like a cliche word over the last few years. But I really love in New Zealand the idea of kaora, and it's around like spirituality, emotional, physical, mental, all coming together to kind of keep the four walls of the whare up, to keep the roof on. And I think that is just like the pinnacle of being healthy, is like protecting all areas and facets of your life and not just focusing on like particularly focusing on your aesthetics. Like that is one thing that we are really hard and fast about at Femi, is just like don't focus on what you look like, because myself, I have been there as a runner and it completely ruined my health. Let's focus on all the things that actually is going to make you a really strong runner. And it is like protecting your emotional and spirituality and everything else as well. So I feel like that works so well. I think the other thing I just wanted to note was around stress. And I feel like also over the last probably 3 or 4 years, stress and adrenaline and cortisol has had quite a bad rap. And it's kind of been seen as almost like the devil, and we don't want that in our system. But as an athlete, and also it carries over to just like normal life, stress is the thing that's going to allow your body to adapt and get better and get faster or stronger or more mentally resilient. And so stress is actually really beneficial, but it's finding the right balance of that stress and rest and recovery, right?
100%. Yep, completely. And it's where you're spot on. And I think we hear messages, don't we, sometimes, and it's dangerous to hear, oh, adrenaline bad or cortisol bad. No. Cortisol is this most magnificent anti-inflammatory that your body wants to make to dampen down inflammation that just naturally gets made through being alive. The trouble comes when there's way too much of it. It doesn't matter if there's too much of it for a minute, but if there's too much of it for a year, you're going to get some feedback about that. But the same happens when there's not enough cortisol. You know, problems arise. But again, if there's not enough cortisol for half a day, no problem. But when you don't have enough cortisol for a whole year, you'll get the suffering of that. And you're right, stress is this most, it can be such a great gift to help, you know, you think if you lift weights, it's really stressful on your body, but it helps us to grow and become stronger. The trouble is, and where I think that we need to be, you're right, we need to be very specific about how we talk about it. It's when it's persistent and unrelenting. And that's essentially coming from our psychology. So that's why I spend a lot of time talking about that, because it's all very well and good to say, you know, people used to say, oh, we need to manage our stress. I don't think that's working out very well for anyone. I actually think we need to address the stress. We need to use stress for our own growth and mentally and physically, but also recognize when it's persistent, because we have a tendency in our nature to be, you know, people pleased to the nth degree, because we're worried that they'll think we're a bad person if we're not meeting every last need of someone else's. Do you know? That's where I think that the distinction, we need to keep making those distinctions.
Definitely. And I guess just always bringing it back to running, because you can tell I'm running obsessed, but in a good running program, it's about periodizing your stress and like applying the stress at certain times throughout your training week to get better, but then also balancing that stress with your rest and recovery. And what we see all the time in the running community is people want to get faster, so they just try and run as fast as they can every single day. And that's just so unsustainable. And so that approach of periodization and stress in a running program, again, can also just play over to all parts of your life, because even now as a startup founder, I'm definitely still finding my feet and when I can be going into big pitches and presentations, and then balancing that with just like at home work behind a computer and not having to front up to anybody, because I feel like my 2024 was very much a high stressful 12 months. And now I'm starting to lean more into like, okay, I need to block out periods of my week or my month where I'm just like not under the pump 24/7, because it's so unsustainable and isn't good for my health at all. How do you kind of take everything you have learned through your incredible career and all of the education and the resources and books that you've written, how do you take all of that and apply it to your life? Because you're also a very successful businesswoman. You've built so many brands and it's really inspiring, but how have you protected your own health?
So I learned the hard way, Lydia. It was why I wrote Rushing Woman Syndrome. I couldn't have written that book if I hadn't lived it myself. And I think too that if I go through something, you know, you might think at the time, particularly if it's health related, I think it's really easy to feel that it's, you know, really tough or tricky, when it's actually, for me, it quickly adapts in my head to it's a gift, because if I can resolve it, I'm going to pass it on. It's really got nothing to do with me. I sort of think, oh, I'm a vehicle to bring a story to life. Just, we all are that, I think. So anyway, so I have lived that. But what I've, since then, I prioritize things. So, you know, lots of different things will come across my desk, my laptop every day. And there are things, it's where my values and my priorities are so important for me to keep top of mind. And I say yes to the things that I really, really care about and no to the things that, yeah, are not for me. And early on when I was first creating everything, that's hard to say no, because you just say yes to everything because you're, you know, super keen to get a message out there. And that's important, and there's times when I will still do that, but it's it comes from a place of I'm doing this with real awareness of why I'm doing it, and you know, for the ripple effect that I hope it will create. So it's that it's knowing my values and my priorities. That's been one of the biggest things. It's also, I feel very, very privileged to get to do work in the world that I love, and my mindset. On the odd occasion, the phrase "I have to do this" will fly into my head, and I check in with myself when I hear myself think that, because what I really think is that I live most days very aware that I'm getting to have a turn on earth, and I feel that that is a great privilege. As I said off air to you earlier, nature is incredibly inspiring to me, and it's also, when I say we look after what we care about, that for me is true for the human body, and what I try to help others to deeply appreciate, for me that's also nature. And I know, you know, obviously when you're exercising, when you're running, I know there's sometimes when you'll be out there and it's just all about performance and what you're trying to achieve with that performance, but then I'm sure there are other times when, yeah, that there's almost like another element that you can't really describe with words, which will be the impact of your surroundings, whatever those surroundings are. It might be that you're in a city that you find really inspiring, or it might be that you're running a particular track that's just blows your mind with its beauty. And I rather than taking time, you know, it's not like I allocate time to soak that up. I kind of do it as I go in my day now, so that, yeah, there's a lot more flow. It doesn't mean there aren't times when I'm like, this is a lot. I still, of course, have those times, but they don't last. And I also usually use that as feedback that I probably just need to look at the sky for a minute.
Oh, yes. You're speaking my language. I love getting out in nature and running on the trails, particularly when I am feeling overwhelmed or stressed. But like, running is part of the time for me performance, but more of the time just about like protecting my mental health and like finding myself at the same time as getting lost, you know. So
love that. What a beautiful phrase. I've got goosebumps with you saying that. That's beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Libby. This has been such an incredible conversation. I know our community are going to absolutely love this one. So we will tag Libby into our show notes. You can go ahead and follow Dr. Libby. We'll also tag in BioBlends, her incredible supplement company, so you can check them out as well. But thank you so much, Libby. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lydia, so much for the way that you care and all the ways you show us that you care. Thanks for making such a difference in the world. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you.